from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George W. Bush and John Kerry just ended a grueling presidential contest that took them both and the nation on a heady, exhausting roller coaster ride to November 2nd. We all know what we saw on TV and read in the papers, but what most Americans only glimpsed was the behind-the-scenes story, the private emotions, the campaign crises, the secret battles fought by both men on their way to Election Day. This hour, we'll look behind the campaign curtain with two reporters who were there, with Bush and Kerry, in the most intimate moments of the long haul. Tonight on Point, the untold story of the presidential election. But first tonight, we go to Washington, where President Bush has nominated White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez for Attorney General, one day after John Ashcroft announced he would resign from the post. If approved by Congress, Gonzalez, 49, would be the country's first Hispanic attorney general. Here he is addressing reporters earlier today.
The American people expect and deserve a Department of Justice guided by the rule of law. And there should be no question regarding the department's commitment to justice for every American. On this principle, there can be no compromise.
Dan Egan has been covering the story for The Washington Post. I asked him to describe the profile of Alberto Gonzalez.
Well, he is a very close confidant of the president. He has a long history going back to Texas, where he was counsel to the governor, George W. Bush, and later was named to the Supreme Court there as a judge, which is why everyone calls him Judge Gonzalez. And he has been very close to the president since being brought to Washington as White House counsel.
There has been a lot of speculation about Alberto Gonzalez as a candidate for the Supreme Court. President Bush has obviously made a choice here. Why attorney general instead of potentially a Supreme Court justice?
Well, technically speaking, of course, one does not preclude the other, but you're correct that the conventional wisdom is that this is the choice that's been made. And in part, at least according to a lot of sources we're talking to that aren't talking publicly but are talking behind the scenes, there was great concerns among many conservatives, especially conservative evangelicals, regarding Gonzalez as a judge, because his position, particularly on abortion, is unclear, and some viewed it as not a hard enough line. Therefore, this is seen as a rather brilliant political move, because it placates both the right and the left, because many on the left are less bothered by Gonzalez than they were by Ashcroft.
What's the character of Alberto Gonzalez as it's relevant to this post? What's he shown in Texas? What, born in San Antonio, public schools in Texas, Harvard Law School, but in public life, what face has he shown the world?
Well, he's actually very not much of one in some ways. He's a very fairly unassuming and presumably will be a less public attorney general than Ashcroft has been, who, as everyone knows, has spent a lot of time holding news conferences. Ashcroft, of course, has a political background, 20 years in political life, from Missouri governor to U.S. senator from Missouri. A lot of people saw him sort of continue kind of a politician's profile as attorney general. Gonzalez, mm-hmm. presumably, may be a little more unassuming.
John Ashcroft was very controversial on the civil liberties front, seen as strong by those who supported the Patriot Act, but as a real enemy of civil liberties by others. What about Alberto Gonzalez on this front?
Well, and in terms of civil liberties in particular, he is not going to make the ACLU and many of other groups probably very happy. He has played a central role, of course, in crafting the administration's policies regarding detention of enemy combatants and that sort of thing.
And torture, where he was seen to have written a memo that sort of cleared the way for torture.
The allegation is that a memo he wrote in January of 2002 essentially paved the way for the abuses that were later seen at Abu Ghraib in Iraq and that have been alleged at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
But more generally, is he on the record on civil liberties as being a friend or being ambivalent when there's a security threat?
He's talked fairly frankly about the tension between the two. He told one of our reporters here at the Washington Post earlier this year that there is a conflict between civil liberties and national security frequently, and that you have to find a balance between the two. He's also been a real advocate for executive branch power, and his appointment would be seen as bringing the Justice Department much more closely in line with the White House.
Do you expect his confirmation to be contentious?
The conventional wisdom on that is that it will be, there may be some flares and some harsh words and some tough questioning from some Democrats, but that he will be confirmed easily.
And, of course, the first Hispanic attorney general, the Republicans have been making some significant inroads in that community in this last election, not least another step in that direction.
Yes, absolutely. And that's been pointed out by already by some Republicans today. Of course, President Bush, I believe, garnered approximately 44% of the Hispanic vote last week. And this certainly is in part going to be seen as a reaching out to that community.
Dan, what's your sense of the timetable now? When exactly does Ashcroft walk out of the building, and when does Gonzalez go before Congress?
That, to be honest, there's a lot of uncertainty on the Hill as to whether they'll try to do this quickly here during a lame duck session that's coming up. But they probably won't have the time for that, though, so I think we can assume perhaps early next year.
And finally, what about the outgoing Attorney General John Ashcroft? He's had health problems in the last year. Does anybody know what's next for him?
He has talked about possibly working in private, perhaps joining some corporate boards, doing some speaking, maybe working with the university. It's not real clear. He's not been real specific on his plans. As a side note, it was interesting, within the last week, a lot of his aides had put out the message that although he has handed in his resignation, he actually was very excited by the election results and would be willing to stay on.
Yeah, we heard that right on, here on this show, and then a couple of days later, out.
The message from the White House was, no, you are leaving.
And as John Kerry used to say, don't let the door hit you on the way out.
Apparently.
Dan Egan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Dan Egan is national reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. The public face of the 2004 presidential campaign was one of a bitterly fought race in a bitterly divided country. George Bush attacked John Kerry for being a flip-flopper. Kerry pushed back, calling Bush a war president out of touch with the reality of war. Bare-knuckled partisans on both sides pounded away on the airwaves, and both men campaigned long, hard, and fiercely across the nation, right up through the cliff-hanging hours of Election Day. That's the drama that played out for all to see. But few Americans ever saw the private face of the campaign, the tense, intimate moments behind the scenes where tough decisions were made, triumphs celebrated, setbacks absorbed. This hour, we go behind the campaign curtain with two reporters who were inside the Bush and Kerry campaigns for months and who were given deep and unusual access to the movers and shakers, the families and candidates in election 2004. Tonight on Point, from reporters who were there, the backstage story of the presidential campaign. You can join the conversation. What do you want to know about the story behind the story of the presidential campaign that's just wrapped up? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Jonathan Darman, associate editor at Newsweek magazine. He traveled for 7 months this year with the Kerry campaign. Jonathan, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from New York is Kevin Perino, correspondent for Newsweek as well, who was with the Bush campaign for the better part of a year. Kevin Perino, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan and Kevin were both part of a Newsweek's election project team and contributed to the magazine's cover story this week, the untold story of an epic election, page after page after page of inside dope. And we're going to jump into it in just a moment here. Happy to have on board to do that with us tonight in the studio, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you right here.
Nice to be here. Hello to our guests.
So, Jonathan, maybe first to you here right in the studio, tell us about this project. How was it organized? I mean, you've put an enormous amount of detail together here. We've got a lot of questions about it and a lot of stories to hear from it. But just tell us, first of all, how did this happen?
Well, the project, this is something Newsweek does every 4 years. It's a Newsweek tradition. So every presidential election, about a year out from Election Day, we separate out a team of reporters who work solely on this project coming out after the election. And the idea is we go to the campaigns and we say, look, we're going to continue with our weekly coverage in the magazine, which, you know, is pretty comprehensive. But we're also going to have reporters who are working on this project. And knowing that, those reporters are completely separated out from the weekly process, Perhaps you can give them some kind of sort of inside access. And what we do is we really, to make them that believable, we create a real sort of Chinese wall within Newsweek. So when we're working on this project, which we have been for the last year, we're not allowed to talk to the people, basically, who put out the weekly magazine.
Saving string, all the anecdotes and inside.
Yeah, exactly.
Dope. And Kevin Prunell, let me ask you, reading through this, there's a tremendous amount of detail on both candidates and their campaigns, but I have to say there's more on John Kerry. You were assigned to the Bush campaign, and, of course, he had the bubble and majesty of the president around him. Were you given – was your access equal to the access that the Kerry campaign gave?
Short answer is no. We had excellent access to the Bush campaign. Mm-hmm. As you know, the Bush campaign is the Bush White House is notorious for not giving reporters a whole lot of access. And so it's always, as we're working on these projects, it's always a little bit easier to get access to a challenger than it is to an incumbent, to a sitting president. But we did. I feel pretty good about the access that we got. We talked to over the course of this year, most of the members of the senior staff of the campaign, senior staff at the White House, the candidates' families. And so we ended up having a pretty good story to tell at the end.
I'd say, Jonathan, give us a sense of some of the most intimate moments that you, the Newsweek team, were able to observe, report out of the Kerry campaign.
Well, what we really were able to do is sort of look at the human side of John Kerry in a way that I think, you know, one of the criticisms that's been made of that campaign is that they never effectively did humanize John Kerry. They never showed the American people his sort of softer side, which he does have. So we got some great intimate moments like that. I'm thinking of March 2nd, the night that he wrapped up the Democratic nomination. We sort of narrate there not just his speech where he accepts it and he talks about the challenge of facing the general election. We look at John Kerry there going home from that event to his house in Georgetown with his family, and he's already completely switched into general election candidate mode. He's on his cell phone. He's trying to line up fundraisers. And his daughter, Alexandra, says to him at one point, she says, "Dad, can't you just appreciate this moment for like 10 seconds? And he says, yeah, I'm happy. And then he picks up the cell phone again. And that really, I think, is illuminative of something about John Kerry, in that he, at that point in time, especially, everyone was talking about comeback Kerry, the fourth quarter player, and how he really sort of gets it at the last moment. His family has always viewed him as sort of someone who's a marathon runner, who shows up and is able to, you know, give a pretty consistently solid performance all the way through.
And they go and go.
Right, exactly. And they were sort of mystified by this. You know, fourth quarter player mythology, because it just didn't look like the guy they knew.
And Jack Peter, there's something right in this story that Jonathan just shared about that cell phone at John Kerry's ear throughout this. Whatever's going on around him, he's always calling off somewhere else to consult with someone, to the point that at a number of occasions, people actually grab the cell phone away from him and say, stop, John, and listen right now. We'll talk about George Bush and what comes out there, but this is not an entirely flattering portrait of challenger Kerry.
No, it isn't. And, you know, the polls show that most Kerry voters voted for him because he was not George Bush, not because he was John Kerry. And this portrait, really, you see a candidate who had very little else going for him other than that he was not George Bush. I mean, he seemed more like an existential flip-flopper, chronically unable to put that phone down, to second-guess yet another decision. And it sounds like one of John Sasso's sort of strategic strokes was just to get that phone away from him.
Yeah, he did that. He did that in a sort of interesting way. He came in. John Sasso, of course, came in
late in the campaign.
It was the second shakeup. Mm-hmm. And he comes on board the plane and is sort of seen as this disciplinary presence. And he did it with a sort of soft touch. Senator Kerry at that point was sort of back to his cell phone addiction and was talking to people all the time. And a couple weeks out, he lost his voice and he was having trouble delivering speeches. Mm. So Sasso sort of used that as his opening, and he said, "Senator Kerry, you need to save your voice. Give me your phone. If someone important calls, I'll give you the message."
Shutting it right down.
Right.
Jonathan Darman and Kevin Prunell with Newsweek magazine. Stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We are getting the backstage story of the 2004 presidential campaign tonight. You can join us. What was the moment when you thought you saw the writing on the wall in this campaign What was most revealing to you of the candidates, their personalities, their prospects on November 2nd? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're getting the backstage story of the 2004 presidential campaign tonight from reporters given deep access to the Bush and Kerry camps right through Election Day. We're joined by Jonathan Darman of Newsweek magazine and Kevin Perino of Newsweek. Jonathan covered the Kerry campaign. Kevin Perino covered the Bush campaign. You can join this conversation as well. What did you imagine was going on behind the scenes of these two very different campaigns? And can you imagine what it was really like to live that long, grueling campaign life? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kevin Perino, I wish you'd lay out for us the kind of basic structure of how behind the scenes, and a lot of this spilled out, I have to say, but about how these two men, these candidates, saw this contest. It really ends up being described as a kind of a personal grudge match at some level, and also a grudge match between two opposing views of the world. I wish you'd lay some of that out for us.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's unclear when the two men first met, but as we say in the story, they almost hated each other before they knew each other. They hated the type that the other man was, and Kerry had said that he had met Bush when they were both at Yale. Kerry was a couple of years older. Mm. Bush says he never met Kerry at Yale. But Bush at Yale was what they called a reg. He was kind of a regular guy, kind of sarcastic, and his kind of guy saw Kerry's kind of guy as someone who sort of tried to a little bit too hard to fit in, and was always kind of striving a little bit more than Bush's kind of guy was. And so They sort of have a personal animosity that goes back years, not necessarily from personally knowing each other, but from knowing the type. And they also, you know, as they're sort of, you know, as they both advanced in public life, they came to see each other as symbols in a way. You know, Bush looked at Kerry and saw everything that he didn't like about blue state America. He considered Kerry a northeastern elitist liberal. And, you know, Kerry looks at Bush and sees everything he doesn't like about red state America. And you know, at one point sort of saw Bush as a know-nothing. At one point, Kerry exclaimed, "I can't believe I'm losing to this idiot."
And yet he ultimately did. Jonathan Darman, I don't want to corral you guys too much. We want to hear your best stories. Take us, I don't know where, in New Hampshire in the primary there or the convention. Dive into the Kerry campaign and the moments that we haven't heard about.
Well, just on this issue of the extent to which they come from different worldviews and maybe have a good deal of animosity between them, I think it's interesting to see how it even gets carried into the next generation. We have a moment here in the narrative after the third debate when, as you'll remember, there was a big sort of brouhaha over Senator Kerry's referencing Mary Cheney's sexuality. Mm-hmm. And what we report in the piece is that Karl Rove was particularly sort of enraged by that because Senator Kerry used the word lesbian.
Honestly enraged or enraged in a calculating way?
Well, Kevin could probably answer that better than I could, but he was enraged.
Okay.
Because in his mind, he thought that lesbian is a more inflammatory word than gay. And I just, as someone who covered the Kerry campaign and really talked to the Kerry family at length about gay issues, I think that just wouldn't occur to them, I don't think, that either word is sort of more offensive, because I don't think they think that either word is offensive. And really, they were quite taken aback by that whole scandal. We have a moment in our story where Alexandra Kerry, the senator's eldest daughter, is sitting at breakfast with her father the morning after that third debate, and they've heard that there's some little sort
something
of
brewing
chatter mm-hmm. about this, but it doesn't really strike them as a big deal. And Senator Kerry goes off to go prepare for a speech, and Alexandra turns on the TV, and she's watching a news conference that Lynn Cheney had did, where she of course came out and said that it was Senator Kerry's referencing of her daughter's sexuality was a cheap and tawdry mm-hmm. Political trick. And Alex Kerry is just shocked, and she's so sort of disturbed that Mrs. Cheney would assault. She called Senator Kerry not a good man. She's so shocked that Mrs. Cheney would assault Senator Kerry's character that she vows, and to if she ever meets Mrs. Cheney, she will not offer her her hand.
So it does get personal. Kevin Prino, inside the Bush camp, what about that kind of, quick trigger, trembling outrage that the Bush campaign could produce just on a dime? We hear about it here over the Cheney incident.
Right.
Was that for real? Was that the tenor of the campaign? What was the atmosphere like inside the Bush bubble?
Well, it was a little bit of both on that one. Obviously, they saw that. They genuinely thought that Kerry made a mistake, and they thought it was something that they could exploit. And so, on the one hand, it was spin. You know, they jumped all over it trying to but it wasn't just spin. I mean, I think Karl Rove genuinely believed, he told us that he thought Kerry intentionally used the word lesbian because he thought that Kerry was trying to shock these 4 million, the Christian right into staying home. You know, we've heard Rove say over and over that he's that he believed that 4 million evangelical Christians stayed home in 2000 as a result
of. Mm-hmm.
Pardon me.
And he wanted them this time. But I want to get
right.
I want to get behind that curtain as much as we can here. Maybe to look at George Bush as a campaigner for a moment. You described Jenna Bush. Mm-hmm. One of his twin daughters, of course, dreaming a year ago that her dad lost, and mm-hmm. motivated by that dream and the fear of it coming to pass, joining the campaign, and that snapping George Bush out of a kind of famous surliness that his staff was very happy to see snapped.
Right. Well, that's something, you know, the surliness is something that's part of Bush's persona. It's just part of Bush. And people, as his handlers were watching the debate, the first debate at the University of Miami Wellness Center, they didn't quite recognize what the to-do was about the peevishness, the petulance, the grimaces, because it's something they see every day. And frankly, the reporters who were in the Wellness Center watching it didn't quite see it as well, because that's part of Bush. It's the flip side of his persona. You know, Bush is one of the things that that Bush is so successful at is portraying this kind of strong leader persona. But obviously the flip side of that is that sometimes he has a little bit of a sharper edge than his handlers would hope, and it's something that they genuinely worried about. I mean, close friends of Bush told us around, you know, in June and July, that they were actually having meetings over at the campaign, realizing that that Bush, as he's a war, you know, trying to be a war president, that it's not always that being a war president and a compassionate conservative aren't always two things that go together. And he had been so successful in the 2000 campaign of portraying this kind of compassionate, you know, kind of warm, reassuring everyman. And they were afraid that a little bit of that was being lost this time around as a result of the war on terror. And so we actually have one scene during the Republican convention where Bush's media team is having a brunch at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, and their guest that day was a guy named Stanley Rechnin, who's a psychoanalyst who wrote a book called In His Father's Shadow about the Bush presidency. And the whole idea of this book is, how are you a war leader and a warm, kind of reassuring, compassionate person at the same time? And so that's what, as Bush's team listened to Rechnin at this meeting, that's what they were trying to find out. How do you bridge the gap between these two things?
Trying to keep the warmth in there. And yet, Jack Beatty, for all that, the public face of George Bush sold pretty well. It sold well at the convention, and right on, we saw what happened on Election Day. I mean, 100,000 votes another way in Ohio, and it might have been different, but it wasn't that way. And the popular vote went his way as well. It seemed to kind of work in a piece with his campaign staff, even if they got used to that petulance, that surliness. On the Kerry side, meanwhile, gosh, all kinds of intersecting interests and themes, not the same clarity, for better and worse.
Oh, no. I mean, it is really a sorrowing picture, I think. And any Democrat who reads it had better do it on a full, well, maybe an empty stomach, I don't know. Because there's a picture of a guy who's just at the mercy of the latest consultant who talks to him, who's being criticized by his wife, who's being criticized by his daughter, who's confronted by his stepson with the possibility, well, you know, things will be, suppose you don't win. People who never seem to have engaged in athletics, where the whole idea is you get up for the big game.
Pump it up and keep it
and
up.
And here are all these people around him keeping him down. Jonathan, I can't understand that. Can you throw some light on that?
Well, you know, to be fair, I think you could argue here that Senator Kerry has the defects of his virtues. A lot of people, particularly in Senator Kerry's party, what they don't like about President Bush is that he doesn't seek out people who disagree with him and that he doesn't look, you know, sort of around the advice that he's giving from people, getting from people.
That
and
is Bush.
That is President Bush. And Senator Kerry, you can say a lot of things about him. That's not something you can say, is that he doesn't seek a variety of opinions. His sort of classic decision-making style is to gather people in a room and get every one of them to sort of go around and state their position, and he'll quiz them, but he'll then sort of end the meeting. It's not a corporate type decision-making system where everyone has to go around and
in other
say
words,
their
there's
opinion.
No conclusion. There's no decision.
No, there's a discussion, and he'll get everyone's perspective, but he won't necessarily even give a clue about where he stands on things. And a lot of times people will describe a phenomenon of they'll read his body language or they'll read the sort of questions he's asking and think he's going to go one way, and he'll really go and sort of decide in the opposite. He's a lot of times when he seems to be showing his hand, he's really just sort of giving you a red herring.
A kind of inscrutability there. What about the people closest to him? Bob Schrum, very, very close and a big power in that campaign. Give us some anecdotes that may illuminate his role.
Well, Bob Schrum, of course, is someone that is widely respected in the Democratic Party. He's generally thought to be a brilliant speechwriter and to have a good sense for how to run a media and a campaign.
Though with John Kerry, he continued his string of
zero
presidential
and, well, I guess,
election losses.
Right, and so now it's 0-8. And, you know, he will perhaps get a fair amount of the blame just because he is so close to Senator Kerry. What Schrum's idea was, and talking about this sort of going negative and all that, early in the spring, when the Republicans were coming very hard, when the Republicans were coming very hard at Senator Kerry, they were doing a $50 to $60 million ad blitz trying to negatively define John Kerry, and you could argue that that really what sort of was what did John Kerry in, that he was never able to overcome that negative stereotyping. Schrum believed that Kerry didn't have the leeway to go negative on the president himself, that he had to define himself positively first, and he had sort of a convincing case to make with the data. So his idea was you sort of get out there, and he and his partners had this idea that you would have this ideas primary and talk about the big issues and really sort of sell yourself to the American people on that and then start talking about your opponent's faults. The problem is in a 24-hour news cycle in today's world where it's sort of about the latest headline, it's really hard to break through the noise when talking about your ideas, and you need to do it in a very crisp and sort of catchy way, and that's not something Senator Kerry always is.
Or Bob Schrum, I guess, working through him. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Lisa's calling from Montclair, New Jersey. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Thanks. You know, rocketing back to what was just said, I think that John Kerry lost the election when he allowed himself to be defined by the Bush campaign and never was able to define himself. He allowed himself to be really denigrated, his record denigrated, and then he disappeared. He didn't come back. He didn't defend it. And by the time he came back and started fighting back, it was just way too late.
Yeah, we saw that play out, Lisa, and let us look at that. Kevin Prino, inside the Bush camp, is that how they saw it? Did they see a man who was not putting his own dukes up, who they could sort of have free rein in defining?
Not entirely. You know, they saw him putting his dukes up too much. I remember Ken Mellman telling us in the Bush-Cheney campaign manager in August, saying that, you know, if the rabbit runs, Kerry's going to chase it. And Mellman had thought that maybe Kerry had overlearned the lesson, Michael Dukakis's lesson in 1998. You know, remember in that race, Mario Cuomo had given Dukakis some of the worst advice in political history, just let it go. And Mellman thought that Kerry was determined not to make the same mistake. And so he over-responded to things. And, the iconic example from the campaign is that I actually did vote for the $87 billion before I voted against it. And so what the campaign would try to do is what the Bush campaign would try to do as often as they could is to kind of poke Kerry, to goad him. And in that example, back in March, they'd seen Kerry going to West Virginia and put together, knowing he was going there, put together this ad called Troops, put it on the air 7 o'clock the morning that Kerry was speaking, mm-hmm. and a heckler in the audience kind of pressed him on Kerry, pressed him on that, and he just fell into this shorthand. So the Bush campaign had a very aggressive, rapid response operation that wasn't entirely designed to respond. It was designed to do just this, which was to sort of catch Kerry in this flip-flop, to listen to everything he says, try to find him, you know, flip-flopping, saying things that were contradictory. The communications director, Nicole Devenish, had a sign on her door that said, "It's the hypocrisy, stupid." And that was sort of the reason for being for the Republican rapid response operation, is to find examples of hypocrisy and then, you know, tell people however they could about it.
They knew what they were looking for. And what about this issue of second-guessing? Jonathan Darmus and Jack were describing the second-guessing of John Kerry that you describe in this long article within his campaign. What about in the Bush campaign? Was there a place for second-guessing, a place for doubt?
There wasn't a whole lot of it, certainly on the surface. I mean, you walk into the campaign headquarters in Arlington, and it's a place where, everybody's always smiling every time you're over there. It feels a little bit like Stepford sometimes. And everybody, you know, Rove, when you ask him how he's doing, says fabulous. Everything's fabulous. People who worked there told us that in the package of news clippings that are distributed around the White House, sometimes they just didn't seem to see any bad news. I mean, it was sort of this kind of upbeat corporate kind of atmosphere at the headquarters in Arlington. And so it was just, you know, in a lot of ways, just the opposite from what you were seeing, over in the Kerry campaign.
But you do describe a moment after the first debate where people really were shaken inside the Bush bubble.
They were. They had realized that. Karen Hughes was the first to realize. She's sitting in this racquetball court at the University of Miami Wellness Center, and she sees that the networks are using these split screens. They had sort of anticipated it, but didn't realize quite how much it was going to be used. And she said, I wish he wouldn't do that. And as soon as, by the next day at the campaign, people told us that it was sort of like that first debate was sort of like the crazy uncle in the attic. You know, nobody mentioned the Bush's performance at that first debate. And they actually they started resorting to almost like a gallows humor. I remember somebody telling me at the time that they had gotten a call from a friend who said people, their friends who heard it on the radio, thought that Bush did better on the radio. And it's not the most comforting excuse in the world. Richard Nixon's from the 1960 campaign, and so Mark McKinnon, the Bush Cheney's media director of paid media, shot back an email to the guy who told him that and said, working to make the next debate radio only, it's not particularly comforting.
Too late for that. Jack Beatty, right. For one moment there, John Kerry looked more presidential and the Bush campaign was worried.
Yes, and they were, and the whole debates went Kerry's way by some margins, by 20 points.
And still swaying back the other way before it's all done.
Yeah, but he seemed to blunt his own momentum, as we'll discover.
We'll hear more. We're looking at the backstage story of Campaign 2004. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're getting the backstage story of the presidential campaign tonight from two reporters given deep access to the Bush and Kerry camps right through Election Day. Jonathan Darmon with the Kerry campaign and Kevin Perino with the Bush campaign, both writing as part of a team for Newsweek magazine, a huge cover story in the magazine this week, the untold story of an epic election. You can join the conversation tonight. What were you reading behind the game faces of George Bush, John Kerry, of Laura and Teresa? And if Ohio had gone the other way, if Kerry had won, would this whole story take on a different tone tonight? And I guess finally, what kind of person, when you listen to this, what kind of person is drawn to run for president, to go through this? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jamie's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Jamie. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. My comment was the following. Even though Kerry lost the election, My feeling is that his way of doing things, his way of consulting, of listening, of gaining some kind of consensus, is really safer for the United States now. And I think that the Bush attitude of going at it alone, this kind of belligerent attitude, is actually more dangerous. Now, I know that Kerry lost the election, and I think that has to do maybe with a kind of problem maybe with charisma that Bush has much more. But when you actually think of what kind of president we want at this kind of difficult time in which we need to consult with other countries, we need to build alliances. Terrorism is not something just here in the States.
And you're wondering if Kerry might have the right personal formula, but of course 51% of Americans looked at it otherwise. It's a great question, and both reporters in a way have something to say about this. I guess first, Jonathan, to you, this issue of Kerry as candidate versus the thing that didn't happen, Kerry as president. Did you see people coming away saying, gosh, he may be complex for the campaign trail, but it would be great in the Oval Office, or not?
Well, I think, again, it has its positives and its negatives in a president. There are plenty of presidents who, you know, have spent a lot of time on the telephone. Lyndon Johnson is the first one that comes to mind.
Famously.
I'm not actually sure that that's necessarily the model for a presidency that Senator Kerry would want to adapt. But, you know, it doesn't have to be a problem that you're seeking out opinions from a variety of people, and it can be, as the caller was alluding to, it can be a great strength in a president. What happens is the question of at what point you sort of stop getting advice and you actually do make a decision, and then do people feel like they can give you advice, and that if they lead you to make a certain decision, you'll stick by them, and that's what, you know, Senator Kerry's leadership style in the campaign might raise some questions about where he'd end up being president.
Kevin Perno, on the other hand, I read a theme emerging through your reporting here of even some inside the Bush camp wondering sometimes if his extreme belief in himself might lead him to look past important aspects of challenges the country's facing.
They didn't. It's actually something his handlers pushed him on. On one of the first ads in the campaign was an ad called "Safer, Stronger," and it was this. It was the one that sort of created this flap, and it was the one with the footage of the firefighters carrying the coffin, and caused this flap of whether 9/11 should be used in ads back in March. And one of the things, as Bush was watching these ads being screened for him before they went on the air, he thought he wasn't worried about the 9/11 footage, but one of the things he was worried about is it too pessimistic? Because he always sort of tended to, his handlers thought, want to run on his record, want to say, you know, we're doing the right thing, things are going right. And his team realized that people in Ohio and other swing states weren't, you know, things weren't quite going swimmingly for them. And so there's this constant struggle of how are you empathetic and positive at the same time? And on the continuum, Bush always tended to sort of want to want to be more positive and want to sort of crow about his accomplishments, and his handlers had to really push him as the campaign went on to try to show more empathy, to show more grit.
To say, Mr. President, not everybody's quite so fired up as you are about the moment.
Right, exactly. And one other point, excellent point that I think your caller made is that we always tend to do these, after when it's all over, we tend to over ascribe, you know, we tend to say the Kerry campaign was a mess because he was getting all these advice, and the Bush campaign was brilliant because it was disciplined and organized.
Yeah.
It's not quite like that. I mean, I think, as your caller said, Kerry, one of the main reasons he probably lost was that he was not a particularly charismatic person. He was a little bit wooden in some ways and had, you know, all these kind of other flaws. So I think it'd be a mistake to sort of over-ascribe just because the Bush campaign was organized and disciplined. That's not necessarily the primary reason.
If it had gone the other way, we might be celebrating that loose network of Kerry advisors. Jeff is calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I've been hearing, I'm an independent here in Ohio, and I've kind of been hearing the Democrats beat themselves up, and I guess others kind of, you know, lay on. And I fundamentally, though, I think, and I guess I'd ask your panel there, but it seems to me there's a fundamental aspect here. I mean, Bush was able to define himself as a wartime president. And I got to tell you, here in Ohio, I was amazed Kerry did as well as he did. Once, you know, I mean, it wasn't quite game over, but once that took hold, certainly here in Ohio, I just think that it's very hard to overcome that, no matter what kind of speeches or, you know.
Yeah, the image of the wartime presidency. And, of course, Ohio ended up telling the story. Jeff, thanks for calling with that. Jonathan Darman, inside the Kerry camp, when they saw Bush putting on that mantle of the wartime presidency, here you had a Vietnam War veteran. We heard so much about this in public. What was the private conversation about how war figured in here?
Well, I think it was sort of the opposite, in that John Kerry really struggled into how much to be the anti-war candidate. He struggled throughout his candidacy. Obviously, as we remember in the primaries, when he was taking such a huge hit from Howard Dean, he was feeling some pressure to sort of go back and rethink some of his stances on the Iraq War. His stepson, Chris Heintz, even said to him, look, you know, you can keep defending your position on the war, and that's good, but you need to, as a son of the, Vietnam, anti-Vietnam protest movement, you need to show some solidarity with the people who were very opposed to this war. And even it really wasn't until the final stages of his campaign that he really sort of stepped into that role as anti-war candidate. And we have it in a moment before a sort of a blistering speech he gave, and a pretty strong speech attacking George Bush's war in New York in September, where the night before he's sort of gathered a bunch of his key advisors, and they're going around sort of saying, how hard a line do we want to take here? You know, do we support this war or not? And then Kerry, you know, characteristically gets advice from all corners, and he finally sort of interrupts and says, it's gut check time, folks. And I'm sorry, I don't have the exact quote in front of me here, but you can look for it in our piece. It's gut check time, folks. There are kids dying out there. The answer is no, we would not support this war.
I've got to ask each of you about the first ladies, or she who would be first lady but won't. Kevin Perino, first to you, and Laura Bush, her imprint on this campaign.
She had a practical impact on the campaign, that's that she was doing a lot of travel on her own this time around. Last time, in the 2000 campaign, she had traveled mostly with Bush, and this time she was away from him an awful lot.
So she was simply campaigning. But what about her influence on President Bush and the campaign dynamic?
Well, she claims that she doesn't particularly talk to Karl Rove and doesn't take political advice from him. Of course she does, and she has a particularly close relationship with Karen Hughes, who came back, who had gone back to Austin in 2000, came back in August, and they both women sort of have the campaign advisors told us sort of have a softening influence. They see things through a woman's eyes, and they tell the Bush when he's being a little bit too strident and needs to, try to soften his hard edges.
So fairly traditionalist impact, as you describe it there. Jonathan Darman, on the other hand, Teresa Heinz, very different, a tough spice sometimes in this mix.
Yeah, I think the sort of trajectory of Mrs. Heinz Kerry's role is something that was misunderstood and underreported in this campaign. It really changed over the 2 years that her husband was running for presidency. At the beginning, Mrs. Heinz Kerry really wanted to be quite involved in a lot of the sort of intimate details of the campaign, and had some strong opinions and really didn't hold back saying so. At one point, and this is in our story, she called up Jim Jordan, who at that time was Senator Kerry's campaign manager. And this was during the summer when, again, Senator Kerry was getting killed by Howard Dean. And Mrs. Heinz Kerry was so upset about this Dean phenomenon that she said to Jordan, I want you to issue a challenge for him to personally debate me.
Howard Dean debates Teresa Kerry.
Yeah, which I would have loved to have seen personally. And Jordan would not have loved to have seen it, and he overruled her.
Saying something like, is she nuts, as I recall.
Yeah, and he perhaps wasn't as diplomatic as he should have been in sort of moving her to the side, and that may have eventually contributed to his demise. But to get back to this trajectory for her, Senator Kerry at some point gets the idea that she's clashing with his advisors, and that to help their morale, he needs to take their side and be the one who's going to play bad cop with his wife. And that put a lot of strain between them. They would get into fights.
On the marriage.
I'm not going to say their marriage was in
or
trouble.
At least their relationship within the campaign.
But they spent, just because they're spending time talking about this stuff, it's creating tension for them. And Mrs. Heinz Kerry, you might say wisely, in the later months of the campaign, really concluded that it wasn't worth it. She was going to keep some of her opinions to herself.
Time to back away, but it came late. Jonathan Dorman and Kevin Perino with Newsweek magazine, a huge, fascinating story. Thanks for sharing a bit of it with us tonight. Thanks to both of you. Jack Beatty, thanks for being here tonight. You can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. In a moment, Hillary Clinton reflects on the role of moral values in the Democratic Party. This is On Point. Having failed to unseat President Bush last week, the Democratic Party is facing a period of soul-searching, and some in the party are already talking about possible candidates in the next presidential election. One of the names that's been tossed around for a while now, for 08, is Hillary Clinton. The New York senator and former First Lady spoke at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts today. After her speech, she took questions from the audience, including one from a student who asked how Democrats could challenge the perceived authority that Republicans have on issues of morality. Here's how Hillary Clinton responded.
It is always intriguing to me that so many people have a very narrow definition of morality and then often try to peg their definition in the case of Christianity, to the scriptures. And no one can read the New Testament of our Bible without recognizing that Jesus had a lot more to say about how we treat the poor than most of the issues that were talked about in this election. And so I would just make 2 points. First, I don't think you can win an election or run even a successful campaign if you don't acknowledge what is important to people. You may not have to agree with them, but, you know, being ignored is a sign of such disrespect. And therefore, I think we should talk about these issues. You know, many very sincere pro-life voters might be surprised to learn that during the Clinton administration, abortions in this country went down 25%, and they went back up during the Bush administration. So just as I have argued for engagement on the part of our government in the Middle East, I would argue for engagement on the part of Democrats in the full range of political issues that matter to Americans, no matter where they live or who they are. They may still not agree with us, but we owe them the courtesy and the respect of taking their concerns seriously. And then finally, as we sort of move into the next several weeks and much of what happened in the election is better digested, I think it will be appropriate timing for people to begin speaking out on some of these matters and making sure that there is a clear understanding of where we agree and where we disagree and where we think individual morality is important as opposed to government imposition of morality. So there's a lot to be discussed, and I look forward to that conversation.
New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton speaking this afternoon at Tufts University. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.